Welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll continue with reading from The Ice Dancer, read to us by its author Connie Ellis of Duluth. The Ice Dancer takes place someplace north of Two Harbors up in Canada and includes wilderness lakes, saunas, and opera-loving sled dogs. Continuing now with The Ice Dancer.
Gabriel wakes with a start. It's cold and dark. He doesn't know how long he's been asleep. He was just going to fix tea after he closed his eyes for a moment. There was still some red in the sky when he fell asleep. He zips his parka, pulls his socks up to his knees, and huddles his knees to his chest to warm himself, finds the flashlight in his small pack and the lantern. He turns on the lantern. Buck said it'll heat the tent a bit, and he should leave it on all night if he gets cold. He puts the rest of his gear on and steps outside with the lantern. The moon is big and low in the sky. It's 2 days until the full moon. The call of nature tells him how cold it really is. He allows himself only a second to think of his warm home, his spacious bathroom, his whirlpool tub. The little kerosene stove starts readily, and he begins to melt snow for a cup of Dr. Sanye's green tea. He dumps in more snow as each half cupful melts to liquid, and he's happy, thinking of Dr. Sanye wanting to meditate and chant for him. Somehow, he's certain he'll do so on the night of the full moon. When the snow water is hot, he pours it into his tin cup with the tea ball filled with green tea, turns off the stove, and carries the tea carefully into the tent, not wanting to spill a precious drop. The warmth of the cup is nearly as satisfying as the tea. Gabriel has had enough green tea to appreciate the quality of this tea. He dips dried apples into the tea and eats a handful of almonds and raisins and a few hard pepper crackers. He's satisfied. He would like to go outside and sit on the big rock and contemplate the moon and look at the stars, but decides to stay inside this first night, let his body adjust to the cold, and take advantage of the warmth he feels from the tea. He reaches outside the tent and dumps the leaves from the tea ball onto the snow, then closes the tent for the night, leaving a quarter of the screen window exposed for moonlight. If he turns the lantern off later, it won't be completely dark. He'll read for a while, then listen to music on his CD player. He prefers not to read and listen to music at the same time. Warning signs. Shivering is a form of exercise which a person can keep up for hours. At some point, the muscles tire and lose their ability to shiver. This is a certain danger sign. Hunching over is another automatic action the body makes in the cold and is a way to protect the internal organs. Persons found frozen to death are often found in a fetal position with their legs pulled in tight. Yet people have been found frozen stiff who survived with surprisingly few ill effects. Often, death occurs when the blood turns to slush and the red cells can no longer carry oxygen, and thus the freezing person suffocates. Safety on ice. After a lake is frozen and the temperature continues to fall, the ice may crack along the shoreline due to pressure. Deep lakes can remain open in the center all winter, while shore ice is risky. In the middle area between the center and the shore is the safest for fishermen. Don't forget that ice is lighter than water. Ice floats and water supports it. Each winter, fishermen become trapped on ice, which breaks away from the shore and floats out into the lake. Enough. He puts the book in the corner of the tent, gets himself ready for bed, zips up his sleeping bag, slips Glenn Gould's first recording of the Goldberg Variations into the CD player. The only other CD he has along is the final recording of the Goldberg Variations. He'll save that for the full moon. Gould's Bach is intimate, joyous. There are no distractions, no traffic in the distance, no humming refrigerator, no furnace noise. The piano has never sounded better than in the concert hall of this Arctic tent. The lamp casts a fire-like glow on the red tent wall, and he decides to leave it on all night. As the variations end, he's feeling relaxed. Gould's humming lingers as a friendly afterthought, and Gabriel feels surrounded and comforted by distant friends, but he ponders the odd dream he had after he danced, when he fell asleep so quickly and unintentionally. He was standing on a wooden floor in a studio with clear plastic cellophane wrapped around both of his hands, and part way up his arms, though you couldn't see it since he was wearing his sheepskin jacket and just his cellophane hand stuck out. He was trying to unwrap the dog, a white dog, somewhat larger than a husky, but short-haired and very white. He had wrapped the dog in a clinging plastic, and it stood there, patient as a saint, its face squashed against the clear cellophane. Gabriel wanted to unwrap the dog, but he didn't know how, didn't know where to start. He was too confused, so he just stood there beside the dog, until she came to help. He couldn't see her face, but she was kind and seemed to be a friend, someone he knew. He woke up before he found out who she was, and he falls asleep, wondering if mermaids could live under ice. Earlier the same day, and further down the lake, Jim Knightman is skinning a rabbit next to his dock when Latos and his dog team pull up. After checking on the team, Latos and Shadow walk over to Jim as he finishes stripping the fur from the very naked-looking rabbit, its pink flesh glistening in the sunlight. "How's it going, Jim?" Leto says in greeting. Shadow moves his nose toward the rabbit, looks up at Jim, who holds his knife upright and shakes his head. Shadow steps back. "Smart," Jim says. "He is. Name's Shadow. He's the wolf hybrid that's driving everybody crazy. I let him run when he was a pup. Now his wolf friends come visiting and howling. Very sociable with the wolves," he says, rubbing Shadow's head. "He's got some real close wolf friends, but I don't know as how he could live out in the wild. Don't know if some of them might kill him. I can't figure him out, to tell you the truth. I've never seen anything like it, the way those wolves come around and howl. I don't know what to make of it. Ever heard of anything like that?" Latos asks as he ruffles the fur behind Shadow's ears. Shadow watches Jim as intently as does Latos. "Let's go in," Jim says, pulling the last of the white fur off the rabbit's back leg. Latos takes a pail of water down to the dogs, then joins Jim on the porch where he has several skins already stretched out a wooden rack, more rabbit, one ermine, and a couple of deep brown pelts. They hang up their jackets and leave their boots on the porch. Inside, Jim hands the rabbit to his wife, Sarah Blue, who smiles shyly at Latos. The house is made of hand-hewn pine logs, and the furniture is pine, all handmade by Jim. The kitchen is the visiting room and the warmest room of the house, and it feels wonderful to Latos after his long trip down the lake with the dogs. Latos and Jim sit at the table while Sarah Blue cuts the rabbit into chunks and starts frying pieces in fat on the wood-burning stove. Latos can smell bread baking in the oven. Sarah Blue's current handiwork sits in a birch basket on a bench beneath the window. To Latos, it looks like a buckskin shirt, or maybe a jacket, and he can see she's started a beadwork flower pattern on one of the sleeves. She keeps her beads, separated by color, in an old muffin tin on the window ledge. Latos has tried to get her to sell some of her handiwork to him in the past, but she says she can't. She apologizes and says it's not good enough, so she can't sell it to him. But it's too good. He knows that. Jim says she's superstitious about it. She'll trade or sell him a quill-trimmed basket once in a while, but not the beadwork. They drink coffee in the blue and white cups Latos traded Jim for maple syrup some 8 or 9 years ago, first year they met. They sit without talking for a half cup of coffee before Jim says, "It may be Shadow is a spirit dog." He tells how sometimes a wolf or a dog or a wolf dog or any animal can be a spirit animal. They're not like other animals of their breed, but have been sent as a teacher or to do magic. He says all animals can teach us about things, but a spirit dog is rare. Any spirit animal is rare. He says there was a white deer once in his great-grandfather's time, and there were 3 bad winters when many of the animals froze and the people didn't have enough to eat. And then the white deer came and walked the hills at night. Every night they said it never slept. The white deer would walk night after night, all winter long, and that was the last bad winter in that region. And ever since the people have had plenty to eat. The spirit deer went away the following summer and has never been seen since. They drink their coffee and listen to the rabbit sizzling in the pan. "I want you to take Shadow," Latos says. Jim is quiet, thoughtful. Finally, he sets down his coffee cup and says, "I'll take him." His mother died of an infection. She and the other four pups, three females and one male. The pups were 2 months old when they died. Shadow was the only one who lived, but he was sick for a month after he was left alone. The father was a black wolf. I only saw him once. Maybe I'm asking too much? Latos looks questioningly at Jim. You are, but I'll take him. If you come to me on this, there must be a reason. Some higher reason, he says. Sarah Blue, you been listening? Okay by you? Jim asks. Yes, I know that dog. One brown eye and one blue eye. Okay with me. But it's the dog who'll decide what's okay, she says. Thanks, Jim, Sarah Blue, Latos says, getting up from his chair. I was hoping you'd take him. I've got a bag of food down on the sled, his collar too, and the leash, in case you want it. You might put it on him when I go. I have to get back for the sauna. Tom Hansen's starting the fire for me, and I'm sure you'll do fine, though I have my own way I like to do it, and well, I need to get back anyway. You two are always welcome for the sauna, you know, any Saturday night. You just come over any time. Stay over in one of the cabins. You just take your pick. Latos stands above Sarah Blue's beadwork in process. Who gets the fancy work, he asks. That's for Angela come so far, Carl's sister, she tells him. Glad he hasn't asked if he can buy it, so she doesn't have to tell him it's too poorly made. She smiles, and they all go out to the porch. Sarah Blue looks out to the lake while they get ready. Nice dog, she says when they leave the cabin, and Latos is pretty sure Shadow will soon be eating fried rabbit. Leaving without Shadow is one of those funny things for Latos. He feels bad leaving Shadow behind. He patted him on the head, but he couldn't look at him, and now he's ashamed that he's glad Jim took him and he doesn't have to worry about him anymore. His neighbors won't be hounding him about the howling. It's a confusing feeling. Something like he gets when he chops the head off a chicken for Sunday dinner. But not as bad as shooting a wounded deer that's got a fawn inside, like he has to do sometimes when they get hit by a car. He just wants the dogs to take him home. The sauna will help. It always does. The husky team takes off smoothly, and soon the sled and the team are racing across the ice. A mile or so past Jim Knightman's, Latos spots an orange flag in the corner of a bright Arctic tent as they near Turtle Bay. He hadn't noticed on the way out, and someone is leaping around, dancing. Yes, my God, someone is dancing on the bay. Latos can't quite believe what he's seeing as his sled nears Turtle Bay. The guy dancing doesn't seem to notice him. How does he do that? Latos puzzles to himself. He's never seen anything like it. The man is almost flying across the ice. Yet he moves in slow motion as he leaps high up toward the sky, like he's going to sail to the sun, then lands as easily as if he's a light-footed deer. Before he knows it, they pass the dancer. If things were normal, he would have stopped as soon as he saw the tent, visited a little, made sure everything was all right. But nothing about the day has been normal, and he doesn't quite trust what he's seeing now. He actually wonders if he's seeing things as the dogs pull on. He assures himself it's okay for someone to be leaping about Turtle Bay like that, as long as they have one of those tents. Going by the unique red-orange color, looks like one of those expensive Arctic tents, good for way below zero, for high altitudes, too. Could be someone from Winnipeg, or even Toronto, he tells himself. A different breed they are, but he'll call Carl come so far when he gets back. Then Carl and Jim can keep an eye out for the guy, make sure he does all right out there. Or should he call? Maybe he really is imagining things. No, he saw him all right. What a day. Latos gets back to the lodge before dark and sees a white wisp of smoke above the sauna. To him, a smoke signal that all is well in the world. The dogs are still frisky and slow to calm down after the long run. They gulp down their evening meal as if they've been starved for days. He's hungry, too. Knows he could have had rabbit and fresh bread if he'd hinted, but he had to get back. Everyone counts on him for the sauna. He likes to think It is as important to them as it is to him, and hopes that it is. He watches Tom come out of the sauna and down the hill to the kennel road. "How's your cold, Tom?" he asks as he shuts the door of the shed where he keeps his sled. "Not too good. It's in my chest now." He stands looking at Latos for word of Shadow. "Yeah, Jim took Shadow. I think it's going to work out. But we'll have to wait and see," Latos says. Tom nods his head. "Well, I'll tell Frozee," he says. "The sauna'll be ready on time as usual, but I'd better go home. I'll have a snort and just go to bed." The two men stand on the road in front of the sauna, smoothing and rearranging the snow with their boots. And Latos thinks about the dancer. He could tell Tom, except Tom has a bad cold. Maybe he'll talk about it at the sauna, tell the guys. Better not mention it to the women, though. They'd think he was off his rocker. Of course, the men might, too. Tom's pain is gone now, but this morning it really hurt, near scared him to death. Felt like someone hit him with the blunt end of an axe or a big chunk of ice right in the center of his chest. He doubts it has anything to do with his cold. "Latos," he says, unburying a pine cone with his toe, instead of talking about the chest pain, "someone called the lodge this afternoon. Let the phone ring about 20 times. I just let it ring. Figured they'd call back. Well, I'm off now. See you," he says as he walks down the road toward his truck, and the crunch of his boots in the snow echoes the rasping within his chest. "Thanks for the fire," Latos calls after him. In the lodge kitchen, Latos fries himself a thick venison burger, heats up leftover Brussels sprouts in the microwave. The twins are bringing hot dish tonight, but he can't wait that long. While the burger fries, he opens a beer for himself in the bar, puts enough bottles of Moosehead, plus a few root beer and cream soda in the bar refrigerator, sets out clean glasses on a tray. He'll put out a couple of bags of pretzels after he eats. He's so hungry he half bites his cheek, luckily just scraping it a little. His hands are trembling from hunger as he finishes his venison burger, and he drinks the beer too fast. Thinking about the dancer as he rinses off his plate, he considers the possibility of UFOs. Not that he believes in them, but say there was such a thing. Now, this part of Canada would provide excellent landing fields, especially in winter with all the frozen lakes. And someone from outer space may look just like an ordinary person, but might have unusual abilities, like that dancer. He looked pretty regular from a distance, taller than usual, though. Something familiar about him, too. He didn't see any snowmobile tracks or other tracks, but he could have come from the other direction. Yet he hadn't heard a snowmobile all day. Latos pours himself another beer, probably from Toronto, or Mars, he says out loud and laughs. By the time Karloff arrives, Leto is slouched back in his big moose antler throne, listening to Yesterday by the Beatles on the jukebox, because he pushed the wrong button. "Hey, Latos," Karloff says, walking across the wood floor of the big empty lodge. "You here already?" Latos says, surprised to see Karloff. Latos has forgotten it's Saturday night. He's forgotten that years have gone by. Karloff pulls up a chair, has a good look at his friend, and sizes up the situation quickly enough. "I'll get us some coffee," Karloff says, and leaves to start the 10-cup percolator. He starts a fire in the fireplace while the coffee perks, knows Latos just needs someone to sit with him, get him through this slump. Happens now and then, though Karloff hasn't seen Latos so bad since his wife left for that professional bowler from Minneapolis 7 years ago. He and Latos and Tom's cousin Otto were putting a big screen porch on cabin number 12 out on the point, the one they call the honeymoon cabin, because you can only get to it by boat. There's no road. Latos thought he would have to put in at least a 4WB road, but cabin number 2 filled up first every year as soon as they started calling it the honeymoon cottage. His wife was gone when they got back from putting in the porch screens. She just left a note that said, "Gone bowling," and she never came back. Latos drank himself into forgetfulness that fall after the lodge closed. Carlos made the coffee double strength, and after half a cup, Latos has already straightened up in his chair and is almost presentable when the twins come in with their hot dish. Karloff gets up to greet them as they head for the kitchen to put the hot dish in the oven, on warm, as is their custom. He tells them Latos is drunk, but that they should act like they don't notice, and he'll come out of it sooner. Just go on as usual, he tells them. We've been doing that all our lives for one reason or another, Carl, Carla. Don't you know that? Millie snorts, surprising Karloff a bit. What's the hot dish, he asks, to change the subject. Macaroni and cheese with raisins and artichoke hearts. We're experimenting for the church food fair, Millie says. For most original entree, Tilly adds. Well, is all Karloff can think to say, just as Greta and Fawn come in the door laughing, letting the door slam behind them. Yesterday is still playing, or replaying on the jukebox, and Fawn and Greta start singing along. Karloff wonders why they're so jovial, thinks this is turning into a really strange day. Fawn tells everyone that she met Tom on the road and she honked so he would stop because she was concerned that he was heading home instead of to the lodge, that he stopped and told her he was sick, and that Latos gave Shadow to Jim Nightman. So that's it, she says, at least for the time being. She asks where Latos is. He slumped down into the past in his chair again. Karloff points and says he's tired from the trip down the lake. He's okay, though, Greta asks. Sure, he's fine, Karloff assures her. Karloff is sure Greta and Fawn have a big secret, but they're not about to tell anyone what it is yet. He doesn't mind. There's plenty of time. Canadians know how to wait.
You've been listening to episode number 9 of The Ice Dancer, written and read for us by Duluth author Connie Ellis. There will be 12 episodes in this book. Remember, you can always go to our website at ktwh.org, and under the Programs tab is Literally from the North Shore, where you'll find the previous 2 weeks' recordings if you want to go back and hear something again or you missed something. Most, if not all, of the music accompanying this book is performed by Connie's husband, Robert Ellis, on piano from his CD titled Moonrise. Today we'll be hearing 6 short pieces by Arthur Honegger. Thank you.
Thank you.